Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greenhorns, this is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio. I am coming to you today live from Maine, from the Kennebec Valley. I guess we are here in very cold weather, talking to Neil Bertrando, who is in Nevada. What's the weather over there, Neil?
It oscillates every day from pretty cold in the evening and nighttime to relatively warm in the daytime. We're at about mid-60s for the highs and usually in the mid-teens for the lows. It's been really dry.
Is that good for, what's that good for? Is that good for fruit because they don't have much pestiness?
Well,
no.
The dry helps and the cold, yeah, both. The issue we have with tree fruits here is that we have unpredictable late spring frost that often freeze all the blossoms off.
So you live in Nevada, and you basically do a lot of things with everyone in Nevada. Almost everything there is to do in Nevada, you're doing it.
I don't know if that's exactly right.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Severin.
What is the unique opportunity that's presented by the ecosystem in which you live, and what are some of the primary ways that you have been engaging with that opportunity in your work?
Okay, well, I think one of the unique opportunities in our region is that there has not been a lot of permaculture specifically done in kind of the cold, high desert, and in particular a region that's both very dry and cold and also gets no real precipitation during the rainy season. Gets no real precipitation during the growing season, although we get very little during the rainy season also. really a lot of our growing season that lines up with the natural cycles occurs on the shoulder seasons. And so there's some unique challenges figuring out how to create ecosystemic agriculture that works both with the natural cycles of growing in our region and also capitalizes on the warm season when we grow a lot of kind of traditional agricultural crops, you know, such as tomatoes and peppers and melons and squash and those sorts of things. So that's a unique challenge, and I work with several different strategies to deal with that, and also one of the considerations there is to look at things that can convert the plant growth during our natural growing cycles to something that's a resource for humans, and that often leads to animal systems and grazing, and so that's something where I'm working collaboratively with some other people to try and improve my skills in that range and offer that to people as well.
Well, and the thing that has been made much clearer to me about the grazing side of things since talking to a lot of these Scottish crofters is that it's an all native ecosystem that you're managing. And so permaculture, we often think about concocting this ecology that serves human needs, and but in fact, in a grazing arrangement situation, it's all a native ecosystem. Although it's probably arranged to our needs somewhat by the cows, they probably distort it to their needs a little bit over time. In fact, definitely. Tell us about your home operation and then what takes you out into the field. What's a typical morning like for Neil Bertrando?
Well, there's not necessarily a typical morning. My work as a consultant and designer and educator often takes me to other locations. So a lot of times a typical morning would be something where I'm coordinating with people and scheduling and getting ready to travel or doing research for sites specific to either doing a consult or a design for a client or for putting together a context-appropriate educational package. Or if I'm actually in Reno, often I'll be managing my home site. So we have a small 1.3-acre homestead that I live at with my wife, and we have right now just a suite of domestic animals that, you know, require daily management. We have a couple of horses, so every day a morning would be taking care of all the animals and then managing our hoop house. We built, as far as I know, the first Elliott Coleman-style mobile hoop house in northern Nevada. And so, you know, managing the crops in there and removing the row cover and checking the water levels and doing harvest. And then checking in with any sorts of potential design clients or things like that would usually follow that up. And then I would also look at, during the wintertime, projects like planning, plant orders, seed orders, any sort of construction that needs to be done for processing equipment or things like that, and getting ready for the growing season at this time of year.
So in that sense, you kind of have adapted your own practice, your own professional life to the ecosystem, that you have your own little nook, but then you range widely to gather from the sparse vegetation and contribute to its vitality.
Yeah, correct. I mean, I try to, you know, practice what I preach as much as possible, and also I feel like that gives me a more experiential perspective to come from when I'm working with clients on a farm landscape.
So how do you prepare yourself? You know, this is a question a lot of people are having is, wow, I would love to have the dreamy lifestyle of going out in the world and helping people start farms and doing, you know, wonderful landscape work and key line work and thinking on a basin scale and doing, you know, doing work that has a significant geographic outcome. And so then the question becomes, well, how do you prepare yourself to be able to do that kind of work? In kind of skills acquisition trajectory, where did you start?
Well, I started by woofing, or even before that, volunteering at the Gorilla Garden at Pomona College, just to get some hands-on activity, and that's where I met you. And I followed that up with woofing and traveling, working with people on farms, just to get again some hands-on experience with agriculture and permaculture. And have continued to kind of both volunteer and pay for educational pathways. So I end up taking a lot of courses every year, you know, as many as possible, usually three or four significant ones that are along my preferred lines of study, and then also going to conferences or convergences and stuff like that and meeting people and talking and trying to continue building my networks, which I find has then led itself into relationships with clients and stuff after having discussions and conversations about some of their challenges and some different perspectives at approaching those and improving their financial or ecological situation on their sites. So that's kind of how I've approached it, is just continuing to follow up on both any sort of hands-on learning experience and signing up consistently for workshops and conferences to meet people.
But you also got like some master's degrees in there, didn't you?
Yes, yeah, I did actually. I had a period in my life where I wasn't really being productive along the trajectory that I wanted to follow in my career path, and found that doing a return to higher education really helped me to become more resonant with that and see what other options were and network with people. And I did an environmental science master's degree focused on water quality and how the urban corridor affects water quality, specifically in rivers. And that ended up leading me to doing field surveys for invasive weeds and things like that along the river corridor, working with the Conservation Corps and a local institute called Great Basin Institute, who I took some environmental survey classes with in college and in graduate school, and then they hired me on to continue doing surveys and then even some restoration work.
It's all very fluid when you look at it in hindsight, but getting, like, stepping from one stone to the next, it seems often requires a pretty strong kind of personal practice. You were saying more resonant with your past. I feel like that's probably resonate with a lot of folks who are trying to figure out what their next little step is going to be.
Yeah, and, I mean, for me, what really helped was to try and clearly define where I wanted to go. And then, you know, from there, I could look at different opportunities and assess if they were something that would take me in that direction. And a lot of times it's just being ready to, you know, say yes to an opportunity that comes along. And then the other side is to, you know, try and create a niche or an opportunity that will help you get where you're going. So
yeah.
An example of that second side would be like the hoop house that we built at our house. We actually partnered with a local nonprofit to fund that, and a couple of people that had taken a permaculture design course with me had mentioned that they were really interested in starting a butterfly house, and they're master's students and graduate students in ecology, and they study native butterflies, and that was one of the things that they wanted to do. And so I thought it would be a great opportunity to look at how we can combine honoring native ecosystems with local agriculture. And so I went and talked to them. They'd mentioned that they'd wanted to do it, and I wanted to build a hoop house at my site. And so we agreed that we would do kind of a joint crowdfunding and raise the money to build the hoop house, which doubles as a butterfly house. So in the summer, it's ecotourism and eco-literacy opportunity, as well as agricultural production. And in the winter, it focuses on just food production.
Wow. Yeah, that's one of the things that's so good at the Sierra Club conference is this understanding that there's way more Sierra Club members than there are ranchers. So if we want to get a lot of stuff done, it can help to be on the same team.
Definitely, and I'm really excited for the opportunity to, you know, bring children out to an experiential environment that's really colorful and live and honors the native ecosystems, but then also puts them, you know, face-to-face with food production and a way to do it that's not monoculture and that's honoring the local organisms as well as, you know, the immigrant plants and animals that help us, you know, with our daily nutrition.
And understanding those as flowing into each other as opposed to being, and I'm here in Maine traveling around in central Maine and just seeing the really profound, settled quality of small farm landscape where the forests are being managed and the land is being managed, but it's a very low impact, low input and low impact production. And some people would say, oh, well, this is not a highly productive, export-oriented, efficient, you know, market-oriented, economic driver, agricultural system, which is all true. But in fact, the settlement pattern is really authentic to the land and really compatible with what nature wants to do here anyway. Anyway, I'm getting all poetic on you. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that that's part of what really we're looking for in the future is to, you know, almost re-romanticize our relationships with the land so that it becomes very rich, and also to examine some of these low-input, low-output types of systems and see if they match our resource production needs and hopefully at the same time improve our visions of our quality of life and our ability to, you know, really engage more thoroughly in our relationships with each other and with the landscape rather than focusing just on production and the financial capital aspects of things. You know, we can honor the social and natural capital that goes along with some of these low-input, low-output systems or medium-input, medium-output systems rather than something like modern agribusiness, which focuses on high-input, high-output, you know, quantity rather than quality type of scenario.
We could have a world where you say, I don't care how much you have in your pocket, all I love about you is your love handles. I think that this is a big project and program of the agrarian way. As you're saying, find the richness in the life way. But in terms of finding the richness in the life way in this economy that we live in now, and in this weird world that you're a part of in kind of managing and contracting and implementing programs and educational workshops and really like inventing a whole kind of shadow economy of education and action in alternative agriculture. Again, I want to focus on some tips for newbies. How you deal with kind of client relations and the transactions that happen within the community and making your living in a kind of a very small, in a small community context. And in that state, you know, as I say, you're kind of connected to almost everything. How maybe your integrity plays into that, how flexibility or reciprocity plays into that. I don't really know what you're going to say, but I think it's going to be good.
Well, I mean, Reno is not a really small community. It's the agricultural community around this area is relatively small because Nevada is such a dry state. We don't have a lot of agricultural production, and small farmers in general tend to group together and know each other at where we are. And so, you know, a lot of it ends up being showing up to events and being, you know, conversant and positive, and also being realistic about the potential of, you know, farming here. I feel like, in general, permaculture pushes people towards the kind of idealism side and attracts people like that, at least as a first kind of wave. And as you get deeper into it and practice it more, it's tempered by reality. and so that's been, you know, something that I think many people probably experience with a permaculture pathway is, you know, working towards meeting farmers and having a lot of people say, oh, I've heard of that, but, you know, that just doesn't work. And so one of the things that I try to do is just listen as much as possible to what other people have to say and their experiences, especially, you know, still being in my youth to a degree. As far as, you know, the farmer spectrum goes, at least. And that's been really rewarding. Also, only going where I'm asked, you know, rather than trying to push something onto people. So both of those are kind of passive approaches in some ways. I mean, you can actively listen and actively put yourself out there, but also really just focus on the opportunities and the positive sides of things and the reality of what's around. And then volunteering. I've done a lot of volunteering with local groups, local nonprofits, and, you know, local small farmers and things like that to get, just to get to know the people and to help build community, again, because that's the kind of, to try and build the resource base that, that will push us towards that local food system that really is resilient, which is part of my larger goal. So really just getting to know people, building on those relationships, and being, you know, being as honest and truthful and generous as possible.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like I'm a little awkward because I feel like we almost lack the language to talk about that deep context of everybody's kind of reputations and their lands and the place that they're coming from and the skills that they have and how even work gets done over time and who does it and how they get it done, and that all of that, as you're saying, also turns into this, you know, really this richness, but you kind of have to really tune into it and manage for it.
Right, I mean, it's just like, particularly in the desert, you know, you need to be able to listen to the land and respond to it, to opportunity when it arises, because it's very punctuated in time often. And I feel like that same skill set can be applied to working with a local community and developing a local food system, is that, you know, being aware of what's going on and listening, kind of keeping your finger on the pulse to be able to kind of optimize opportunities as they arise, is an important thing to be aware of.
So we have 2 minutes left, and I want to make sure that if there's something burning on the tip of your scheduling event announcement, super exciting thing in your world that you want to announce. I have some exciting announcements for the end. Any upcoming courses or challenges that you see in your immediate ecosystem that you want people to know about?
You bet, yeah. Well, we're really honored to have Craig Sponholz coming up to teach a water harvesting course for 2 days here in Reno. I'm partnering with a nonprofit, Urban Roots, and they work locally. They just started a Farm Corps program as a branch of AmeriCorps training young farmers. And so we're running a PDC through that, and Craig's teaching the water harvesting portion. That'll be February 8th and 9th here in Reno, a 2-day weekend course. And then we'll have a presence at the Nevada Small Farm Conference, which is February 20th through 22nd, which is a really great conference here in Reno, Nevada, for local small farmers. And then I'll be traveling down to San Diego to the Permaculture Voices Conference on March 13th through 16th, which is a big national conference, which I'm really excited about. I think it's the first of its kind here in the U.S., and a lot of big names will be there. So that's really exciting, and we'll have a permaculture design course, a Permaculture Research Institute permaculture design course following that at a PRI Tipuana Farm in San Marcos, which is just north of San Diego. And that, as far as I know, is the first Permaculture Research Institute site in the United States. So that's exciting, too. That's coming up.
Yeah, and also in the ecosystem that it is with all those amazing tropical fruits, subtropical fruits.
Yeah, it's a fantastic edge where you can grow everything from kind of the temperate fruit range all the way down through, you know, mangoes and bananas when you find the right microclimates and stuff. So it's a really rich food producing region with potential if you can get the water.
All right, so this is all in the permaculture calendar, and you can find all the dates. Craig Sponholz is an amazing master of water slowing. And what's the web place where people can go?
It's urbanroots.org, urbanrootsgardenclassrooms.org. And there's an agroecology and permaculture program there to find those courses. We'll have Owen Hablitzel teaching grazing planning portion of that course in April also. excited to be bringing in, you know, professionals from around the country to help us keep a high quality of the course content. Eric Tonesmeyer also taught as part of this course.
Yeah, you guys are like the next generation, like Darren Daugherty, like just like permaculture rock stars just roaming around in your tour buses.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we all really have the same goal, which is to create a positive impact on the land and within local communities. So it's really important that, you know, any of the kind of nomadic teachers and permaculture workers are connected with people that are rooted deeply in the landscape, because that's what really makes the difference in the long term, is the work being done on the land that's managed and maintained by people that are rooted there.
Yeah, I just came across, my friend Amy sent me a link for a union, oh no, it wasn't Amy, it was Kevin, sent me a link of a cultural workers union from the 1880s. I thought, oh, that's nice, cultural workers, that's what we are. Okay, anyway,
right, yeah.
I think people know how to find you. I will save my announcements until the next time. If you happen to be in Maine tonight, I'm giving a talk tonight in the Belfast Library for the Camden Conference on 6 years or 7 years now of Greenhorn, and then on Thursday at Halcyon Grange in Blue Hill, Maine, about our new community history project, which is called Grange Future, an examination of Grange revival in the U.S. You can check out more on the Greenhorn's blog for details. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you, Severin. It's been great.
I send you lots of love.
And vice versa across the
versa
North American continent.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.